Chers auditeurs, chères auditrices, bienvenue à Radio Créum et à la balado-diffusion du colloque en mémoire de Jerry Cohen qui a eu lieu à l'Université McGill le 27 novembre 2009. Dear listeners, welcome to Radio Créum and to the podcast of the conference in memoriam of Jerry Cohen that took place at McGill University on November 27, 2009.
Joe Cairns from the University of Toronto Political Science Department, who will be talking about stuff to do with incentives, I take it. Those of you who've read Jerry's last two big books, and even the little book, know that Joe occupies a very important place. A book that Joe wrote about a quarter century ago was sort of rediscovered by Jerry and used as a sort of launching ground for a lot of Jerry's most interesting recent thinking about incentives. But he definitely gives credit to Joe as sort of the Copernicus of the kind of view that... no pressure, Joe.
Thanks a lot, Daniel. So I have two reasons to be very grateful to Jerry Cohen, one personal and one professional, and I'll start with the personal reason. I met Jerry in 1985, fall of 1985. I just moved to Toronto on a visiting basis, and Jerry was giving a talk, and I went up and introduced myself, so he generously... you know, he recognized my name. He'd read some of my stuff, and he said, "Let's get together and talk." And so we took some time. He was giving a series of lectures, and so we went off and talked. And it was a moment of openness. It was striking. I'm usually kind of shy and not very forthcoming, but this was a moment when we had a real connection. And in the course of this conversation, I won't reveal lots of it, but he. We were talking about, I'd just gotten married, and he said, "Well, are you thinking about having kids?" As we were talking about family life and things like that. And I said, "Well, yeah, we were thinking about it. But, you know, we had just moved there. Jenny had just been denied tenure at Princeton. We had what the philosophers called a two-body problem as distinct from the mind-body problem, you know, trying to find two jobs in the same place. So lots of things up in the air. He said, "Well, you know, how old are you?" And I said, "Well, I'm 40 and Jenny's 36. He said, "Well, you better think fast." So, you know, it's a kind of just offhand, witty remark, typical of Jerry. But somehow that really sank home. And I went home and I talked to Jenny about this. And about, you know, 3 months later, we stopped practicing birth control. And 6 months later, she was pregnant. So this was a kind of life, and things were still not resolved in our lives. I mean, Jenny had got a job, but I didn't have a job. You know, things were... very uncertain, but there was a way in which this conversation came at a very important moment for me, and you know, it kind of encouraged me to embrace life, not worry, not work it all out, figure it all out, and just plunge forward. And so that was I told him that story on more than one occasion. I've always been grateful to him for that moment. So the professional, the reason I'm grateful to him professionally is the point to which Daniel has already alluded. I published this book in 1981, and it immediately, well, it did do some good. It got me a job at Princeton, rescued me from Lake Forest College, but then it immediately sank into obscurity, but to be rescued from that by Jerry Cohen, who picked it up and was attracted by some of the questions I was asking and the problems I was dealing with, and then made all of his students read it. Probably Keith had to read it, you know. That book had any kind of afterlife or visibility only because Jerry would make his students read it, and I've always been grateful to him for that. So I'm going to tell you a little bit about the book and what I was doing and how it connects to Jerry's work. It's going to be much less polished than Will's presentation. So I became interested in this question. I started thinking about the issue of moral incentives. It was the late 60s, you know, Cuba and China were all the rage, less information particularly about China than we had subsequently. But part of what was inspiring to people on the left was the idea that here were societies, and in Cuba, you know, did a lot of this, so they were providing education, providing health care, and they were trying to build a society that was based on commitment to the members of the community on an egalitarian basis. And, you know, the idea of the phrase used then was the new man under socialism. It was the new man. This was a pre-feminist period, you know, it's just the emergence of socialism. New man was the word that was used. So the idea was that you could build a society in which people were motivated by a desire to serve one another, not altruistic, because you would also be served, right? But it would be a better way to live, to commit to one another. And I, along with many people, thought of this as an admirable and inspiring vision of a better way to live than kind of consumer capitalist society and just trying to struggle and get on top and get the most that you can. All of these experiments seemed to be very disappointing in various ways. And it seemed to me that the problems had more to do with their reliance on central planning than with the problems of motivation. So people tended to say, well, you know, you can't run a society that way. Those motivations are ineffective. And yet you would read stories about Cuba where people were willing to work, but things were riding on the dark because they hadn't figured out how to coordinate getting the raw materials to the places where things needed to be built. And it wasn't that people weren't willing to work hard and devote themselves to these efforts. It's that they couldn't organize things. And by contrast to the kind of the progressive capitalists, if you will, at the time, could be characterized by, so those people within kind of social democratic mentality, they liked the idea of equality, but it was captured by the title of a book by Arthur Oaken called Efficiency Versus Equality, The Big Trade-Off. So the idea was the more you moved for equality, the more you had to give up, efficiency. And, you could find some balance. They weren't just for efficiency, these kinds of people, but that was it. So I thought, well, there's something wrong with that, too. Why should there be a trade-off between efficiency and equality? Why can't we think about how you could get efficiency and equality? And the way to do that would be to combine socialist motivation and then socialist distribution, the idea from each according to abilities to each according to needs, combine that with the capitalist organization, the use of the market for calculating relative scarcities, communicating information, decentralization. All of that seemed good about the market. What was bad about the market was both the motivations that it cultivated and the distribution that it generated. So get the administrative advantages with the motivational advantages of socialism and put them together. And I first suggested this in a footnote. I was writing a paper for a course taught by a guy named Charles Lindblom. Some of you will recognize his name. I put it in a footnote in this paper. I said, oh, of course you could do this. I thought of this as something that was completely obvious. And Lindblom wrote a note, well, what are you talking about? And so it wasn't obvious to him that you could do this. And so sure enough, so then that became my dissertation. You know, this thing which I had thought was so obvious seemed preposterous to him, as it still does to most people. But anyway, I wrote this dissertation, which then became my book, and spent several years working this out. And I only was worried about the logic and the feasibility of combining efficiency and equality, combining these motives, because it seemed to me the desirability of that was obvious. See, I never learn, you see. at least it should have been obvious to any egalitarian, I thought. So then, you know, people did point out that maybe it wasn't so obvious that it was desirable, even if you could do it. So then I did write a little piece in the middle 80s in Political Theory. This was actually from a letter that I communicated to Jerry. I'm going to quote from that part about Rawls, if I can find the page that I wanted to, here it is. So Rawls makes institutions central to his discussion of justice, of course. And Rawls himself introduces the language of duty, though he doesn't develop its implications systematically. So it seemed to me that you could say, look, duties as well as rights could be chosen in the original position. In the original position, you select principles and corresponding institutions for distributing the benefits and burdens of social cooperation. That's more or less a direct quote from Rawls. But Rawls actually doesn't say anything about the burdens of social cooperation. He's got that in there, but then he doesn't say anything about it. So in this essay, I tried to show why Rawls should have endorsed an institutionalized duty to contribute to society by making good use of one's talents and skills, even if you will not receive the full market price for your efforts. And then I tried to show that if people internalize this sort of duty, then you can get this redistributive system going. It doesn't even have to be the ultimate. Anytime you internalize this sort of duty, it creates space for taxation, for redistributive taxation, you see. And I try to show this sort of duty is a logical concomitant of the egalitarian commitment that is entailed in acceptance of the difference principle. So that was that little article. And again, I thought, well, so that's pretty obvious, isn't it? And needless to say, it wasn't. So there's a way in which most people just ignore that. But then Jerry was interested in this problem, and he, of course, saw complexities, difficulties, puzzles around the whole Rawlsian apparatus, the basic structure, other questions of incentives and freedom and so on that I had scarcely begun to touch upon, and he began to work through these things in his various writings, and he got people to pay attention to those issues. So that was kind of the link that we had. I wrote some long exchanges with him, but I never published much else on this topic. I moved on to questions about immigration, and then it's really Jerry who had developed that whole set of complex issues, which, as I say, I thought were obvious until I started reading the things he had to say. I could see it wasn't quite so obvious after all, just like for the other issues. Okay, so here's the broad set of issues I want to put on the table that I think Jerry is addressing in this work, and which I'm interested in as well and hope to return to someday. So when you're thinking about what justice requires, you can't ignore questions about motivation. What motivations do we want to encourage and discourage, and why? And how should we go about this? Or can we be indifferent to human motivations, at least from a societal perspective? Should we leave it to parents and to nature, what motivations people have? Well, I don't think that's a plausible position. It's not an option. And let me say why. Even from the perspective of democracy. So take the idea, what makes democracy work? The idea, a lot of people have now written about democratic virtues, right? Democracy requires a shared political culture. People have to be oriented towards compromise. They have to have respect for procedures. They have to be willing peacefully to cede power. They have to tolerate differences of opinion and differences of ways of being. All of these things are prerequisites for the effective functioning of democracy. It can't function unless both elites and the general population develop certain habits of thought and behavior, dispositions, and so on. That's just one kind of, so motivations matter in politics, right? But the same is true of economic institutions. So capitalism is thought to rely on greed and fear, and it does, of course, but it doesn't rely only on those by any means. There's the famous Adam Smith problem, some of you will know. You know this. So he's got the wealth of nations thing, but he's also got this stuff on morality, and how do those two go together? That's the kind of problem in Adam Smith interpretation, but there is a way in which that problem is reproduced within the structure of capitalist society. So capitalism cannot function if everybody is simply motivated by fear and greed. It can't function if everybody is always calculating his or her narrow economic self-interest and acting on that basis. Well, why not? Well, take the idea that you want property laws that are enforced. The judges, the police, the civil servants. If they're always calculating their narrow economic self-interest, then they'll take payoffs. There'll be all kinds of ways in which the system won't function. You want them to be deciding what's the right thing or what's the fair thing, or kind of deciding on some basis other than their own immediate narrow economic self-interest. So you have this puzzle built into the whole logic of capitalism. Lenin famously said, "Honesty is a bourgeois virtue." Now people say, "Oh, it's communist, they don't care about honesty." That's how people read it. But actually it's an analytical point, right? That in order for capitalism to be, also said, under feudalism, loyalty is the feudal virtue and honesty is the bourgeois virtue, because that's what makes the system function. You need people to internalize these moral norms for the system to function properly. It can't work unless most people are honest most of the time. It doesn't require everybody to be absolutely honest, but unless most people are honest most of the time, the system won't work. And you see that, for example, in societies where you have problems of extreme corruption or dishonesty, that capitalism can't thrive. You have to kind of transform the culture and create that as a kind of shared norm. So if honesty is a bourgeois virtue, then we might ask, well, what are the virtues that are required by a just and egalitarian society? What are the virtues required by a socialist society? Again, I think you can see even within corporations going back to and I think that in a way is the center of the question that Jerry is asking, right, and that I'm very interested in as well. What are the virtues that are required in a just society? What kinds of motivations, what kinds of orientations, what kinds of dispositions are required by a just society? And here he's posing a. And so I just want to add about the market here, though this is less Jerry's emphasis, but it's more my focus, that people tend to assume, as I say, the market is only driven by greed and fear. So I already say, well, you've got these other problems of the background conditions of the market itself require other dispositions. But even within market activities, corporations can't function if everybody within the corporation is constantly acting, again, on a kind of self-interested rational actor calculation. There are very few social institutions that can function on that basis. You need people to have solidarities, professional norms, a certain willingness to engage in teamwork and cooperation, and so on. So even within capitalism, these things are required. So we can't ignore the normative questions of what sorts of motivation are morally desirable, as well as how effective different sorts of motivations are, and how they come to be institutionalized. And it seems to me that what Jerry has done in his grand book at the end, is to argue that contemporary liberal theory, especially in Rawls's version, has neglected these questions or presupposed a limited and problematic set of answers to them, and that justice requires, in fact, a commitment to others, a willingness not to be purely altruistic, not to be self-sacrificing, but a willingness to forbear, not just to kind of take everything that you can get, but a sense of fairness. And he argues that that is compatible with freedom, it's not unreasonable, it's perfectly plausible, and I think he's right.
Thank you. Okay, I'm going to put myself on the list, by the way. So, Pablo.
Just a quick question. Gunther and Sarah places when he's referring to your view that
he finds it as a good template for further work on how to disengage considerations of motivation from considerations of information when it comes to the market and so on. But he also says that he finds some problems perhaps with it, but he never engages in a discussion of that.
Yeah.
I'm sure you had some conversations with him about, I'm not trying to get at what's wrong with your view, what I'm trying to get at is that, I'm trying to follow up the what I'm sure was an interesting conversation between the two of you that was didn't emerge in writing. But I wonder whether there were some disagreements, some issues that you were considering and probing together. And I'm just thinking for the future.
No, well, I actually had an exchange with him in the early 90s. When his incentives lectures, the Tanner lectures, were coming out, I wrote 20 pages of single-spaced comments on the version of these lectures that I thought, and he said, thank you very much, these are great comments, I'll have to engage with them, but I never actually explicitly responded to the specific points I made, and then my work went in another direction, and so I've never actually pursued some of these issues. I mean, broadly speaking, I think his concerns, first of all, the original version of the argument was one that said, look, take what it had a kind of formal quality, right? So people are motivated by a desire to acquire income for consumption. That's one of many motivations in a capitalist system, by the way. Lots of, people want satisfactions from work. They have all kinds of things. But I just said, imagine replacing that with a desire to contribute to society, and you can get everything. If we assume for this argument, contrary to the kind of classic Marxist view, with the fettering and so on, if we assume for this argument that capitalism is ideally efficient in its existing form. Now, there are a lot of reasons to object to that, but I just wanted to take the harder case. Let's assume that it is efficient in its current form. Then how could you reproduce that efficiency? Well, you could reproduce it by just changing the motivation, then you can redistribute once you get this different motivation. And then I tried to make an argument about why you could replace that motivation. So some people thought that this desire, having people solely focused on contributing to society, that was too strong a motivation. So this has to do with the idea of, to what degree are we enslaving the talented by requiring them to contribute? So that was one issue, which I then corrected for partly in a later article, I think, saying, look, all that you need to, without worrying about technically reproducing every element, all that you need to have an efficient system is to have people feel that they've got a duty to make good use of their talents and skills. Now, what's good use of your talents and skills? Well, the market price is going to tell you what's good use of your talents and skills. And by the way, in a society in which income was distributed equally, plus you had some collective provision for differentially incurred basic needs, market prices would be a reliable indicator of what other people thought ought to be produced and where the relative benefits and of different kinds of combinations of production would be good. The reason that it's not good in our society is because there's this vast inequality of income, plus you don't have the compensation for needs. But if you address both those things, so that was one kind of indicator. It was and this is a problem that he's deeply engaged with, which is the problem of how much can we expect of other human beings? What's reasonable to expect and what's unreasonable to expect of other human beings in terms of contributions? What's the space for just doing what you want because you want to do it? Where do you get to take your own preferences and inclinations into account? And where do you have some duty to contribute to others? So that was one issue. I don't know that we really disagreed, but we'd have some back and forth. I disagreed with some of his formulations and challenged him on some, and he had problems with some of mine. And the related issue has to do with freedom of occupation. Mm. Is there some inconsistency between this idea of inculcating motivation of this sort, having a duty, and freedom? So the short version is, I don't think there is. That the people who think there's a conflict, that this is somehow an impingement on freedom, can't then explain, you know, it seems to me it's the same logic of any moral duty is an impingement on freedom. So there's a, I think people like Rawls have a now you see it, now you don't quality to the relationship between freedom and moral duties. And, you know, they're prepared to introduce moral duties without suggesting they're any kind of constraint on freedom for some purposes, but not for others, and they don't explain why they work in some areas and not others. There's no argument given for that.
Jacob.
On my first reading through Rescuing Justice and Equality, I wrote out a long note to myself about what I perceived to be a huge gap between you and Cohen where you were right.
Good.
that on my second reading through, I found a footnote from him wherein he seemed to think that everything you said could be simply taken on board unproblematically. I want to try to spell it out and get your read on it. The note to myself had this form. Karens is to Cohen as Hayek is to Rand.
Can you say that again?
Karens, I would say that it's not very complimentary to Jerry. I would disagree with it on those grounds.
Karens is to Cohen as Hayek is to Rand. The story in Rescuing Justice... The story in Rescuing Justice and Equality about what would make the difference principle pertain, what would make the inequalities justified by the difference principle pertain, is the story of giving big prizes to the talented. And then there's an examination of whether that is a morally justified thing, that the talented might hold their contributions hostage and only agree to release their contributions if they were paid really, really big ransoms. But, says I to myself, recalling the contributions of Joe Karens in the 1980s, one of the things that can make the difference principle pertain, one of the things that can make it be the case that inequalities lead to the benefit of the worst off is the informational function of markets and wages, markets and labor. And I was going through hundreds of pages at a time of Rescuing Justice and Equality and seeing no evidence that this had even entered into Cohen's imagination about one of the things that could make it function. And as far as I can tell, it's the really important thing that could make the difference principle true. Now, Rawls himself may not have known this or understood it or thought it, and there's stuff in Rawls to suggest the really big prizes for the talented people view too. But it seems to me that you set this stuff straight a long time ago. One of the reasons why it could be the case that inequalities in labor markets lead to economically beneficial outcomes even for the worst off is because the markets reveal information about where the talents are to be deployed.
And that is a Hayekian insight that I'm drawing on. That's right.
Yes.
Yeah.
I find myself completely dissatisfied with Cohen's attempt to just have one footnote that says, well, insofar as that's true, Joe Karens has taught us that progressive taxation can solve all the problems. It seems to me that what you had to say requires us to recast our thinking about what would make the difference principle important, about the basic mechanism of the difference principle. You seem not to think this. You seem to think that your view and his are closer than I was perceiving them to be.
So the way I...
So please set me straight.
Well, I don't know. I think one difference of temperament between Jerry and me is that I was much more interested in this institutional problem. How do you work these things out? How do you organize these things? And he was much more interested in the question of principle. And it's a kind of philosophy, political science divide in some ways.
Which I'll be talking about.
And I think he sometimes assumed, and Rawls sometimes assumed, and wrongly so, that inequalities that remained, so Rawls says this explicitly, well, those are fine because they're simply compensating for the differential burdens of work. Whereas what we know how a market works, market rewards relative scarcity, it pays lots of money to people to play sports that they love to play if they're very successful and they earn a lot of money. So it's not actually that the economic, it is true that the relative burdens of work affect the price of labor, but it's swamped by other considerations of relative scarcity. And so the problem is disentangling those. And I wrote another piece where I tried to show how it's impossible to disentangle them. I think Jerry is not so much interested in those kind of institutional things, but his basic sense is, rightly, that it's not an inequality if people are getting extra money because they're having extra burdensome work, so there can be that kind of compensatory trade-off, but otherwise there shouldn't be economic differentials. On that crucial judgment, we agree, but then I think the institutional mechanism is a lot more relevant. And with respect to the difference principle, the key here is Rawls is not willing to see that if you pay attention to motivations, you can get, this is the key argument I was trying to make, right? So the thing should be arranged to be the greatest advantage to the least well off. Well, if we're willing to work hard, not harder than anyone else, just as the average difficulty, all things considered, and not take any extra money for it, because we're willing to submit to taxation without reducing our efforts, then the poor can get a lot more. The least well off can be much better off. So it's kind of like he wants to separate those two things out, and he doesn't, as far as I can see, offer any defense of it. But Jerry and I are on accord on that score. This has to do with whether or not you can insert the difference principle into the question of motivation.
The new man needs a market in wages to see where to contribute efforts.
Exactly.
Is it your view that the new man only needs a market in pre-tax
and
wages
woman.
And that the after-tax take-home that doesn't distort the informational signals?
Right. So imagine that your after-tax income is all the same. Now you go out and spend it, and there's relative scarcity. You're what you want costs more than somebody else, so you have to spend more on it. So everybody's got an equal income share. Again, separate thing for differentially incurred needs that might be provided socially. But everyone's got an equal income share. Now market signals are communicating to you in terms of your labor prices where your particular bundle of talents and skills can be most productive, contribute the most to other people's well-being. So the pre-tax income. So that's information. It's all about information. You're right.
I think it might be in tension with what he says about Dworkin, and I want to ask you about how your own view fits in with what he says. And I think this might be best illustrated with the case of Cuban oranges for two reasons.
Cuban oranges, okay.
Firstly, because Jerry very generously wrote a letter to Merton College for me several years ago saying that I really, really needed to go to Cuba and they needed to pay me to do so in order to improve my philosophical education. And I think I've never actually had reason to comment on this in the context of philosophy since then, so it would be a good thing to do now. Secondly, because it actually quite illustrates the problem quite clearly. So the problem in the Cuban orange fields was that people would go and not act like the new man, but would go and snooze and not pick many oranges. So I think in your book, you want to solve the problem there by saying we need to internalize the duty to pick as many oranges as we sort of reasonably can in the time. If you take Jerry's look egalitarian view, I think he would say, well, no, you have a choice. If you choose to pick four oranges and everyone else picks 10 oranges, then we deal with that problem by saying, well, you're the one that gets four oranges. You're not going to distribute your suboptimal choice across society.
Right.
I want to ask you whether you have, I mean, to me that view seems more attractive because it gives you the choice about what you're going to do. If you want to optimize your choice, then you can do so, but at the same time, if you want to sleep, you can sleep, whereas your view achieves the same end for society but doesn't give the choice to the individual. So I want to ask you whether you have time for Jerry's view instead of your
So that does capture one of the differences between us. And it's connected back to this idea of institutionalization. So if it were true that you could arrange things. So see, what makes that story plausible is that everybody can pick oranges, and if you choose to pick four oranges rather than 10, it's not because you're shorter or weaker or have some thing that inhibits you from picking 10 oranges in the same amount of time with the same amount of effort as anybody else, right? So it's a background presupposition, which is the attractive thing about kind of let's adjust income and burden, right? So you say, imagine two people with exactly the same sets of talents and skills, and now they make their choices, and whatever they choose is just fine. So that's fine. But we don't have two people with just the same bundles of talents and skills. There's a tremendous range of talents and skills. And we have no way of sorting out what part of it is burdensomeness and what part of it is, well, they like to do it or they don't like to do it. There are questions of subjectivity and objectivity here. And so the best we can do, which is not perfect, is to ask everybody to contribute a reasonable amount. Because when you start going down the route that Jerry wants to go down and that you want to go down in that way, what you wind up with is reinforcing the existing inequalities. Because this depends on an empirical claim. My general sense is that on average, better paid jobs are less burdensome and more rewarding than poorer paid jobs. That's not 100% true, but just on average. And if you think that's the case, then the best way to kind of minimize the differentials is to give everyone an equal income. Maybe some special cases here of burden that you can identify. But for the most part, because of this intermixing of the burdensome issues with preference issues, with relative scarcity issues, with incentive issues, there's no other alternative.
I have two more questions, Dominique and then Jürgen.
I think I've lost my voice yesterday, so I hope I'll be able to go through the end of the question. But so one of the reasons why I've always really liked Rawls' division of labor argument, so the fact that, you know, principle of justice should apply to the basic structure of society, is the fact that it always struck me as being extremely difficult to have an effect on people's motivation, you know. So have them more oriented towards justice ends. So you said that you were more interested into the institutional problems, and you said also that so one of the issue that Cohen pointed towards the first version of your argument in your book is the question of, you know, how can we change or impact have an impact on people's motivation. So I'm wondering if now you almost 20 years later you have an idea or a suggestion or on about how we can do this or achieve this.
Well, I'm not sure what you have in mind. I never thought that one of Jerry's strong objections to my line of argument was the difficulty of constructing motivation. But so in the second half of the book, to begin with, I tried to show that motivation turns out to be a very complex thing, both within the market and outside the market. You know, if we think about how is it that people get motivated? Well, you know, Is there some natural set of motivations? You have to be taught to be a rational economic actor. Polanyi makes that point, right? This is not a natural kind of thing. You have to be taught that. You know, your parents raise you. They have certain models for you. They teach you certain things. So if when you're growing up, your parents are telling you it's really important that, and so we all have that, right? That's how gender roles get established. That's how all kinds of social orientations get established, through parents, through schools, through peers, through social networks. So if all of these decentralized informal networks had internalized a norm, take the way today, it's wrong to be racist, right? So you get that diffused throughout society. Now, not perfectly, you know, right, there are lots of problems, but compared with what it was 30 years ago, a big difference. If that kind of norm were diffused similarly, you've got a duty to get a job and to contribute something to society, to do your best. They're not actually so far off from kind of old-fashioned norms that we would be taught, you know, to whom much is given, much is expected. These are kind of in the Bible and, you know, kind of, you know, if you've got some talents and skills, you should make good use of them. And so that could be just diffused out there, and then it creates space for redistributive taxation. Doesn't have to be the extreme model of my ideal, but it just it creates more space. And if you ignore that motivational question, John Rawls has no basis for criticizing the hedge fund, you know, these kind of, and I do. That's better.
Yeah, Jürgen.
Two very small points. The first one relates to the discussion between Jacob and yourself. And it's like one of the things that really struck me when I read the last book, well, not the socialist one, the one before a rescuing book, is that we were all familiar with sort of Jerry's argument about how economic incentives are not really necessary and then deconstructing all these sort of arguments. But then he really has that chapter where he says, well, even if they are necessary, we just shouldn't call them justice. Mm-hmm. And this is really his big, big move in that book and say that, look, you know, even if in the end we might have all the sort of reasons we want to think that that gets us the best possible world we have, stop calling it justice, right? Mm-hmm. So that's the one, I think, the one big thing that was missing out of that conversation.
Yeah, fair enough. Yeah, good.
And the second thing is about your own solution. I mean, there's one possible complement to your scheme, and this is the sort of Philippe Van Parijs-style basic income, which is basically to say, well, you know, okay, it's fair enough, we can't disentangle the burdens and all these sort of things. So let's not just tax people to equal income, but let's tax the rent component, some approximation of it. Let's give everyone an unconditional basic income. And from that floor, on the one hand, we have a better distribution of, you know, sort of egalitarian distribution. But then on the other hand, of course, it has all the sort of dynamics in terms of allowing people to move in between the jobs that they really find too burdensome and so on and so forth. So I just wanted to know what you thought about it.
I think as a practical matter, as a kind of social policy, there's much more likely of getting some sort of basic income than there is of getting the kind of schemes that I have in mind. So I'd certainly support that as a progressive move and a step in the right direction. I think I have a deep disagreement with Philippe that I, again, goes back many years arguing with him. I remember sitting with him, and it has to do with he thinks it's an infringement on freedom to have for people to have any sense of social duty to contribute, and I don't. I don't think of that as an infringement of freedom. And so he's got a kind of a conception of freedom that I don't share. And so that's, I think, the basic difference.
One comment and one quick question. First, on the issue of Jacob and you, I think that Cohen do acknowledge the informational basis that could justify income inequalities, but in fact not justify it, but that would make the difference principle true. But he says that the inequalities would still not be just. So he will refer to Philippe Van Parijs, in fact, examples where markets and inequalities are necessary to have an efficient economy, but that doesn't make him for him it doesn't make the inequalities just. My question is how maybe it goes back to what Dominic tried to ask you. I'm really convinced by the effectiveness of motivations to achieve an egalitarian outcome. I'm just not sure how it would be feasible from now to change these motivation, or I would like to know what are your proposition to change the kind of motivational framework to bring us toward a kind of more egalitarian society while retaining the desirability of the whole enterprise.
There are various levels of feasibility, but it seems to me, and I think Jerry's had places where he's talked about this, you know, if you contrast the levels of inequality of income in earlier periods, so we're going in the wrong direction is the bottom line, right? So whether it's feasible to move that around politically is another question, but there's no reason to believe that people have to have these vast income differentials to be motivated or compensated for burdens or persuaded to take up jobs as captains of industry and bankers and lawyers and doctors and...
Yeah, I know. My question was more about political feasibility, since some have, right now, they have a bargaining power, and we must acknowledge this. And so if we try to just change the motivations, they can just decide not to participate.
You can't possibly change the motivations without changing the broader political culture, right? So that's what a progressive political movement is trying to do. I mean, in a tiny way, you know, if you look at what Obama's trying to do in the United States, right, he's trying to shift the political culture in various ways. He may not succeed, but that's the very modest, within the framework of what's possible within American politics, he's trying to shift it so that there's more solidarity and less of this kind of individual devil take the hindmost kind of thing. Now, maybe he won't succeed. In Europe, obviously, you don't have that. You have a very different setting. There's a lot of more of that is entrenched. It's all under pressure from the global capital dynamics. So so ultimately, it's, you know, if you look at Jerry's work and you look at my work on this issue, we all talk about society. So there's that huge looming problem there. But what about the rest of the world? And how does this fit together with that model? And that's, you know, I don't know that anybody's addressed that adequately.
So you think Derek Jeter could be persuaded to play baseball for less than $33 million a year?
Exactly.
I mean, in a way, this is more a question for Jerry than, but maybe you could stand in. It seemed to me that the Jerry's, the position that Jürgen attributed to him rightly in Rescuing book, which is that if you have all these sort of, you know, incentive structures that are going to lead you to the right kinds of results, but the people within the system are going to be acting sort of for the wrong reasons, just don't call it justice, sort of elides one moral attitude, which I think is actually one that is present. So you can imagine taxation, for example, being something where people sort of, you know, they'll do everything to try to cheat the tax man. They'll have kind of what Hart called an external relation to the institution, right? And really what we have to do is enforce and survey and have as much, we have to catch cheaters and everything like that. Another attitude is to say, look, you know, I know that I won't do it myself. I know that if it was just purely voluntary, you know, we suggest that you give away 50% right. of your income. I know that I'm not strong enough to do it. I wish that I were, you know, I would want right. to have that. And so the way in which I'm going to sort of implement that desire, that second order desire, right. is through a system which I'll have an internal. So when the tax man comes around, it's not that I see it as this external, you know, just these guys coming around and taking my money.
Yes.
It's something that is an expression of my own moral agency.
Right.
So I think that third way between sort of, you know, the kind of individualistic, I fully internalize the difference principle, and the other one, which is, you know, I'm just going to view the tax man as this bad guy who's taking my money away for no reason that I can endorse. That third way, which is sort of accepts that we have these second order desires that we don't always act on when we don't have the sort of constraint.
Well, I'm completely in agreement with you.
But, you know, I mean, is it the case? I think that Jerry just missed that, right? He just missed that as a possible full-bloodedly moral attitude that one can have.
Well,
it's just not it's not just remedial. It's not
right,
just.
Right. No, I agree with you. In fact, one of these passages has a note to that effect
right.
on exactly this point, that in institutionalized social duty is there's a danger in some of his formulations that it seems to be entirely an individualistic morality
right, yeah.
is self-centered as opposed to an institutionalized morality.
Right.
And just in the way that you yeah. said, I agree.